Welcome back to Shadows from the Tree, the podcast where we wander through the darker corners of genealogy, unearthing the mysteries, secrets, and shadowed branches that shape our families. Our theme on this last episode of season three is love triangles. It's one that we love and have included in all seasons so far, and I'm really interested, Michelle, to see where you went with this, because I tried to go a slightly different angle than before. But we did, I did hear from you that yours is a little bit more juicier. So you're going first because I want to hear.
Okay. Wow. So I go and I type in love triangles for early 1900s. And this one was, they literally called it the crime of the century. So yeah, okay. It's really juicy. There's even mention of some of the famous names in the Gilded Age show. So we're going to talk about today the love triangle of Stamford White, Evelyn Nesbit, and Harry Thaw.
Okay. None of them ring a bell to me. So
no. So yeah. So we're going to go back to Evelyn Nesbit. She was born on Christmas Day, 1884. Very, normal average family. It was her parents, and she had a younger brother. They lived in Pennsylvania, and her dad ended up passing away when she was, young, like 11 or 12. And then, her mother was left to raise her and her brother.
Yeah.
Her mother was a seamstress, and from a very young age, she was known as a real beauty, the daughter Evelyn. So there were artists who had taken pictures of her and started painting her, and she ended up going to New York and was making quite a significant, at the time they were able to board at a little place in New York City, and she was getting more and more recognition for her beauty.
Like through, more so through the arts?
Yeah. Would you say? Yeah. Versus so there like was like, you know, or drawn, like that's how she started. And then she ended up in a Broadway show called Floridora. And when she was 16, she was like one of the chorus girls in that. And a wealthy architect started taking a liking to her. So now at this time, she's only 16.
Yeah. Older architect?
Yes. We'll get to his age in a minute because it's deplorable as usual. Like, with the current theme of even now. I felt like this really hit home on so many levels.
Okay.
So here we go. So poor Evelyn, trying to make earnings, and met with these famous painters and photographers. And there was one, his name was Gibson, and he would take, young girls' pictures, and they were called the Gibson Girls. So it was kind of like well known. They were like the up and coming, they were hot commodities basically. And that's what the whole like theme of this is. Like women were treated as, as usual, as objects and things that we just not even people things. Yeah. So that's really what disgusted me most about this whole thing. Anyway, so
especially
we go
when
to
they're so young.
Yeah, we go to Stamford White. He really put up a nice front in front of her mother. Was willing to, I'll pay for this. I'll help her with her teeth. He got her teeth fixed by a very fancy dentist. And so he was her benefactor, okay? Ugh. And he was 48 years old. Yeah. He was already married. He was already established. So Stamford White, he was very well known. He designed and built the Madison Square Garden.
Oh, cool.
And the Washington Square Arch in New York City. Okay. And he built houses for people. And there's houses in Newport that he designed and built. So
good portfolio.
Yeah. So he was well known. And I watched a documentary on YouTube about this morning, and there's like so many more details that it's like creepily connected to like what's going on now. So let's go back. Like 1895. There's this big soiree. It's all like these really well-established, wealthy older men. There's like 40 of them. There's this picture of them all around the table. They're all dressed in their best. Yeah. Their best. There was like 10 courses. Every course had champagne. They went through 140 bottles of champagne. And then at the end, they brought out this pie. And when they cut in the pie, there was like birds that flew out of it. But then there was also a girl in the pie. And so
I think I've seen those like showgirls.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I think that's where it came, yeah. like came from that. And all these famous men and this poor girl, they take her into a, and then she's not seen for years.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, and the names that were there, one of them's that,
wait, are we talking the Gibson girl? One of the girls?
Yeah, she was like,
was in the pie.
Yeah.
She was in the pie.
Yeah, she was in the pie and then disappeared. And then they like ran her name through the mud about how like deplorable those kinds of acts are and blah, blah, blah. And so who was there? Stanford White. So there's like all these famous names. And the one that stuck out to me was Tesla. And I thought it was so weird.
Did you go down that rabbit?
That like Nikola Tesla and then what's going on now? Like, it just underlines that the wealthy people, yeah. let's just get away with everything. And I didn't know that was the kind of person that he was. Like, I was taught he was this great scientist, this great, you know, mind of the time, and this architect. Like, I didn't know.
Dirty laundry, yeah.
Right. But, like, it's because who writes the stories?
The power, right. Not
the people
ones.
Who have money, the people who have power, the people who are in the patriarchal.
True.
You know, like, it took, I don't know, how many women to say their stories.
True. It's
and
so true.
Still, it wasn't believed. So, that's just, I know. And now we're going back 120 years where women were even treated as
even
less more equally. Objectively yeah. than, you know, it's just terrible. Anyways, let's go.
Okay, yes. Where did she go all those years?
Let's go back. We'll go forward again. So he's her benefactor, this Stanford White, and he ends up paying for her to go to like a boarding school in New Jersey, and she gets like appendicitis, so he pays for his personal doctor to go take care of her, and then, you know, she comes back to New York to kind of recoup, and then she starts getting visitors while she's like recuperating, and there's this guy who keeps coming, and his name is Henry Thaw, and he starts like showing a liking to her. He's from a very wealthy like train tycoon family of Pittsburgh, so they have like money, like he's like aristocracy type, like, and like they just, but like his dad was the one who, you know, made the like family and money, and then he was just kind of like
it, yeah.
he was living off a trust basically. Yeah, he was doing whatever he wanted, and he was a drug addict, like he was not great, but he showed a liking into, look at how beautiful she is.
Oh, yes,
this
Johnny.
Is Evelyn.
Oh wow,
her hair was gorgeous.
Yeah,
she always
she
like
presented herself. Yeah,
they said she always like was very emotionful with her eyes, yeah. and could like light up a page, and she just sold a lot of newspapers for
yeah,
these wealthy men.
That face that's yeah. very
yeah,
model like where you can just
yeah. She was really beautiful.
A natural.
Yeah, but they called her the first bona fide sex goddess is what they started referring to her as.
At 16.
Yeah. So so we go to Thaw, and he's like really infatuated with her, and he's like started to like go after her, and he had a reputation of, you know, being a little unstable, as we would like to say. And he offered to take her to Europe because he wanted to show her like all of the finer things. And she was kind of like, I don't know, I need my mom to come because we need a chaperone.
Yeah.
And the mom was like, well, I kind of have this suitor who wants to marry me, and I don't really want to go to Europe for 6 months while I have this going on. And so her mom actually went to Stanford White and was like, hey, is this a good idea? And Stanford was like, that guy's bad news, you don't want to do anything with him, and was trying to like
stop. Oh, that's good then.
Right. Well,
or was it for his own benefit?
It was for his own benefit, okay. Because we there's a part of the story where he became her benefactor after he like would have separate meals with her and dinners with her,
oh.
and was groomed her in, okay, so he had
yep,
this place pretty close to where she performed, and he would like have her come to his house. And there's actually a movie that it's called The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing. And he had a room with a swing, and it was like very like playful, so he would get like girls to trust him and stuff like that.
That's so bad.
Yeah. And then she talks about how he brought her into his bedroom, which was green walls with mirrors everywhere. And then he fed her champagne until she passed out. And then probably had her way. Yeah. And then she woke up and was naked in his bed. And like,
he raped her.
Yeah, exactly. So that's how he became, and he made her promise, like when she woke up the next morning, he made her promise not to tell her mother or anyone because she would be like basically cast out of society for being dirty and like,
yeah. Something that he did.
Yeah, exactly.
Can't even.
Yeah. So disgusting. So, but I've read all the articles. They're either like he was, you know, framed for this, or some articles did say he was like the devil incarnate because like they showed like some statue on one of the buildings he created with like cloven hooves and stuff that he was a bad guy. But all of the men in this story have pretty much not been redeemable in anything I've read so far. But
did other women come forward about?
Oh yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. That's why she wanted to marry. She ended up marrying Harry Thawb was because she was afraid that she was going to lose him as a benefactor because she was getting a little bit older and she knew he was with other women and had like attentions elsewhere. So she was worried for her future and she knew Harry had money. It was kind of I don't know what to do. But at first she didn't want to marry him and she told him kind of what happened. So she would kind of convince him that maybe he shouldn't marry her because
she's been whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So she was honest and said what happened, and he went out of his mind. And he kept, like, asking her for details and what happened, and did it happen this way? Did it? Like, he was, like, obsessed with...
I thought I knew what you were going with this, but maybe now my brain's shifting here.
So he was, like, obsessed and jealous and was, like, out of his mind with rage and just kept asking her. And apparently there were times where he liked... torture and whips and things of that nature. So in her like later biography, she explained times where he was very abusive and not only verbally, but so neither of these men were good anywhere.
But she felt the pressure of society
and the culture. She's so high up, like she's gonna, if anyone finds out about any of this,
life's over, everything she knew is over. And not only that, she's got the family component of her mom working so hard to raise her family that she's responsible to help, you know, in a way.
I know. But her mom also didn't protect her from these vile, like,
that's true,
men. She kind of just was like, well, we're making money now. Yeah. You got to do keep what you got to do, I guess.
It's true.
Unless she just, like, put the blinders on, didn't know, didn't want to know, didn't care to know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so we're back. They end up, she does accept his proposal and they get married, but it's not like you would think, like that much money, you would think a big soiree.
Oh, yeah.
But his family is not impressed with her at all. She doesn't come from, you know, money and respectability. She's this, you know, floozy actress. Kind of like eugenic.
She's not going to help the family.
Yeah, she's not helping us at all. So the mother was like, nope, closed ceremony. No one but, like, us and the judge, like, nothing. So they had it in, like, their house in Pennsylvania, and there was no...
And if the son was already having trouble with his own career status, and he was marrying someone not to do off, that could have brought the son's reputation down, too.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So there was a time where she, like, kept out of the spotlight after she first got married, but he kept doing whatever he wanted to do, of course, in the city. So it all came to a head when they had decided they were going to go to, I think it was England, somewhere in Europe. They were going over there, and they had to go to New York to get the boat out. So, like, the day before, they were going to go to dinner and then a show. And so they had come up with, prior to this, so they referred to Stanford White as the Beast. So whenever Thaw would ask her about...
Is the Beast going to be there?
Is the Beast, yeah. So that was kind of like their...
Do you know if when he got married, was he still like the beneficiary for her like career? Or did that get handed over to the new husband?
She wasn't really working at that. When she first got married, it was kind of like she was kind of being held back.
Yeah.
But so this was like the first time she had been to the city in a while, and they had gone to dinner, and she saw Stan. She called him Stanny. Stanny was coming in, and he sat down across the room, and Harry was talking to the other person in their dinner party and didn't notice right away. So she like frantically wrote on a piece of paper, "The bee is here."
Oh, no.
And so she puts, and then he's looking around and he sees them, and then he's like, "All right, let's go early to the theater. We don't want to miss the show." So it was actually at the Madison Square Garden, I think, and up on so they're up there, and they're sitting there, and Harry sees Stanford come in, and Stanford sits like right at the front, and he's like watching all the chorus girls, and like one of the final songs comes on.
Oh gosh, I'm bracing myself.
So Harry had purchased a gun, and he had it on him, and he went up right to Stanford White in the crowded like theater in front of everyone.
What?
And Stanford stands up when he sees him, and Harry shoots him 3 times in front of everyone. Like once in the shoulder first, then like under his eye, and then right like through his teeth got like shot out. Like crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
While the girls are on stage.
Oh yeah. And everyone was like kind of like didn't do anything.
Probably.
Yeah, they didn't like. No one around until one of the chorus girls started screaming because it wasn't part of the show.
Yeah.
So then everyone's frantic and screaming, but he like held the gun up like he was like hoping someone would come, and like he was like doing it for whatever, and he's like,
I did it
for my wife's honor. But then no one was doing anything, so he just started walking towards the elevator. And she says, "What have you?" Because they were already like ready to go. That's what happened. They were getting up to leave, and he went up front, and she was in the near the elevator. And she's like, "What just happened?" He's like, "Don't worry, it's over now. He probably would have killed you, or like something like that. Like I saved your life."
Oh my god.
Basically, yeah. So then we get to the trial of the century, right? So
okay, let me just say, at first I thought she was gonna be the one who died.
I know, that's usually how it goes, but she really is the victim here. That's what I want.
Yeah.
That's what I want. Like, I want everyone to be, that's my opinion on this. That is, if I'm writing the newspaper article today, this is like, I've even read stuff on PBS, like they were saying, "Oh, Stanford White, well, he was the victim." I'm like, no guys,
no,
he was literally
abused,
pedophile who groomed young girls. Like, this is not okay.
Crazy.
I don't care what he built. I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, this is not.
Crazy.
We're not doing that. It's 2026. We're not doing that anymore.
No. We're rewriting history right now.
Sorry. Not sorry.
No.
So now we're in the trial of really diabolical, just. So his first set of lawyers, Harry said he did not want to plead insanity. There's newspaper headlines saying, "I am not crazy." And they were like claiming this unwritten law of like protecting your family and like American values, where Stanford White had tarnished his wife, so he was like righting a wrong, and that was their defense, which is like not even a law.
Legal,
so how are you defending that? And it's not even, it's just like this unwritten.
And he's got a history, so the other side's probably going to dig into that.
Exactly. So there was a. Like, they didn't end up convicting him then, so they had to do a retrial. This one was much shorter, so that one lasted, like, 4 months. The next trial only lasted a month, and he had a new set of lawyers this time, and they were doing, like, more of the insanity kind of.
That didn't work the first time. Let's try it now.
Yeah, and they ended up bringing poor Evelyn up to the stand, and she had to, like, relive
everything.
She had to tell about, how he became her benefactor, and in her testimony that time, she said that the champagne tasted bitter, so, like, that she was drugged her. And there's all these other things. Like, there was this affidavit that she had supposedly signed because she had told Stanford White about how terrible Harry was, and she wanted to leave him. And then that affidavit, she said, was fake, and it was this whole other thing. And so she did that because they were threatening to electrocute Harry Thaw, and she just thought he was not mentally stable. So she felt like that was not fair to him to get electrocuted. Right, she was trying to protect him in that way. Yeah. So she gave that kind of a testimony. But he did end up with a not guilty verdict with due to insanity. So he ended up going to an asylum where, of course, his mother paid for him to have a four-post bed, and he got meals from, I think it was Demonico's or some, like, famous rest. Like, he was...
He lived really
well. He was okay. And then in the documentary, I saw he actually ended up escaping after, some, I think it was 3 or 4 years. And she was pregnant at some...
Okay, yes. She met someone else.
Maybe or maybe not. She said that was due to like a conjugal visit.
Oh,
that
possible.
But he said no. She said yes. So there was a son born.
Okay.
Let me pull up his name. I think it was Russell.
That's interesting.
Yeah, Russell Thaw. So she even kept the Thaw name, naming him Thaw. Yeah. And then his family was like, oh, she's just doing it. She wants our money. And no.
So they remained married.
For a bit, till I think it was 1915 when he was out, and he was like, I'm done. And she said, great, that's wonderful. I do not want anything to do with your crazy. So they ended up being divorced, and it seemed like everything for him was going to go better. There was some weird, he tried to escape to Canada when he ran away, and some like extraditions happening. He was in New Jersey, and then New York, and Pennsylvania, like... Okay.
He was all over the shop.
He was just like, mom was paying him to like protect him everywhere he went, right? But he ended up at some point, he wanted to be the benefactor of this guy named Freddie from California he had met, and paid for him to come to New York. And then there was this whole thing where he said, all right, go take a bath after we go to dinner. And then, there's this, like, and then when he comes out, there's no towel. And then poor Freddie's like, what is happening? And he's like, you're going to be my slave for the next 4 years.
What?
And then whips him and beats him. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. And then, you know, probably also rapes him. So, yeah, psychopath. So everything we told about Thaw was...
Oh, yeah.
He's a... raving lunatic.
Not a good guy.
No. Yeah. Terrible. So he wasn't protecting anyone.
Well, luckily
he was
she just, got away from
him. Yeah, she did. She survived it.
And who knows if the child was really his or not. I mean,
who knows? He kept the name Thaw, and they were actually in several like silent films Hollywood in like the early like 1915 to 1919. She was in like five like Fox.
So she got her career back.
Yeah, Fox films, and there's actually video I saw on YouTube of her in the 20s, and she's sing like you could actually see her singing.
Oh,
it is like
cool.
The coolest thing.
Well, I'm so glad that she made it.
Yeah.
Through right.
Yep, she made it through. There were some later. Like suicide attempts she had because she was, you know, because that was like towards the end of her career. She felt like, you know, nothing.
She
drank some disinfectant or something. And
jeez.
Yeah. But she ended up, she cleaned up after that. She got help. She got treatment. And then she found spiritualism. So like Buddhism and karma. So she felt like she had never dealt with what had happened to her.
Yeah.
So that's why like all these demons had built up inside. And she finally was like, working through it. And later in her life, she actually became a sculptor, and some of her stuff's really cool. It's like you know, like bodices and like, you know, how she like the woman's form, and it's really cool. So I'm looking into more of that artwork. It's really neat.
That's awesome.
Yeah, Harry lived pretty long too. He lived till he was in his 70s, but there was only like 10 people at his funeral, and he left most of his money to his nephew. He did leave Evelyn like $10,000. So,
okay.
I mean, they kind of like he wrote a book and she helped him like with the publicity tour, which was
really
weird. Yeah. And then she wrote another book where she talks about the trial and how Harry's lawyers really fed her like mouth, like what she was supposed to say and how she was like the drugging and all that. And she came back and said, the most thing she regretted was saying that when they asked her if she had ever loved Stanford White, she said she never did because he was a monster, but in actual, she did love him. But I'm like, but you were groomed, so.
Right.
I don't know.
Is it your mind
just
not knowing or being
And she said, oh, well, after what first happened, he showed me a world of art and culture and stuff that I would have never seen. I'm like, okay, but he used that like, he used
against you. Against
you. Yeah. So, I don't know. Still, I think she had some demons that were...
Yeah.
That she was really dealing with her whole life. And she said, like, one of her final interviews, they asked, like, if you could live your life over again, would you? And she said, no, I've already lived it once, and that's that's enough
that's
for
cool
me.
That's cool. They had a final interview, like, a
yeah. interview and she her. Said that... Stanny was the lucky one because he got to die and she had to suffer through life. I was
oh wow
that's really dark. So it did sound like she had like genuine feelings for him, but I just felt bad. Like she said, she had
too,
to suffer. She had to suffer, and guilt too, because she was kind of the cause of his demise. But he really was the cause of his own demise.
It would have caught up with him one way or another. I would hope.
With all of his deviant things. So, yeah, this was a really...
And I'm impressed, Michelle. You guys aren't here, but, like, this is all... Like, she's remembering all these in her head. I struggle to do that.
I'm not reading anything.
That's awesome.
Just a few notes here and there. And I don't know, the pictures, everything, like, seeing her live on the screen. And, like, I watched the movie that came out in the 1955. You should watch it. It kind of, like, flopped when it came out. But I'm picturing, like... That was my grandmother's era. I'm picturing her going to the movies and like, and then she got to see that. And then I'm also, you know, talking about the story. And I don't know. I feel like these are stories I don't want lost. Like I want, because it's still happening. Like we're not learning.
Again, I know.
We're not learning. And it's still like, oh, who is it? The people who can pay to have it covered up. And like nothing's going to happen to these people. Like we all know how terrible they are now.
Yeah.
Well, now they still have the most money, so
what
are we supposed to do? They're still in power.
Like, true. It's
what
true.
What are we doing?
And it's scary, because like you said, they didn't... It's not changed.
Yeah, we're supposed to learn from this and change. And, like, I thought...
And take Evelyn's personal, you know, story,
Yeah. No.
Well, that was in... Yeah, I'm about to check out the documentary. That was a good one. You made a twist for me. So I was thinking, something totally different.
No, it was really good, and it was one of my favorites, and I hope that we can, like, find more things like this. And her family, she still has, like, she has descendants, too.
Oh, that's cool.
Like, Russell had children, and there was, I think there's a granddaughter where I saw her posting on something on YouTube, like, this is my great-grandmother and stuff. So
that's cool.
Maybe she'll listen, and that would be so cool if she could reach out to us.
Reach out to us. Let us know if you have any more details or how the story got told through the
family.
Insight
on it, any insight. I think they kind of, like, brushed most of it under the rug from what I saw, but.
I would imagine. Yeah. I feel like those further back generations, but I think. Like the great great grandparents, the great great great, you're like, you really want to tell their story, like we did with ours, you know. So good one, Michelle.
Oh, thanks.
Very awesome.
All right, your turn.
So mine, I guess, could have some similarities, I guess, in a sense, but mine was not a headline at all, and it really took me some like deep diving to sort of put it all together, should I say. And I'm actually it's been a state I don't think we've really been to. Maybe you had a guy who was like crazy going to different states, but I don't think we've told a story from this state. So, all right, here we go. So at first glance, it looks like a simple marriage, a name, a date, a certificate filed away in the archives, but behind it, it's a love triangle, and not the kind that we usually imagine or the ones that we've done in the past, because love triangles don't always mean three lovers. Sometimes they mean three competing forces.
Oh.
Yes. First, there's the person caught in the middle. Historically, that person is most often a young woman.
Yep.
As you know, her future shaped not by her own voice, but expectations, the family duty, community pressure, tradition, reputation. She's, you know, being asked to grieve a future she imagined with maybe someone who could have been her true love.
Right.
Second, there's the approved match, the one that looks right on paper, socially acceptable, financially stable, respected by the community, and the one she should choose. And in my story, the third are the parents, positioned between care and control, between tradition and fear, often believing they are protecting their child while quietly taking the choice out of her hands. But emotionally, these type of love triangles are cold, strategic, and deeply conflicting.
Yeah.
So, my headline in my story I found was Probe Story of Girl, 16, Forced to Wed Neighbor. Marriage arranged by parents, she says, leaves husband. Just funny that it's a 16-year-old, right? The headline ran through Nebraska newspapers in January of 1920, the Lincoln Star, the Omaha Daily Bee, the Evening World Herald, the Star Herald, and this wasn't whispered gossip, it was public affair. And if your name was Schlesinger or Hoff, you weren't just reading the paper that morning, you were trying to manage a conflict that was happening. So in this episode of Shadows from the Tree, we're untangling what really happened behind the headlines. We're looking past the tidy records and into the tension hiding between the lines. Was the marriage even meant to last, or was it unraveling before it began? And when family, reputation, and control collide with personal choice, we asked what's left behind in the shadows. So we're going to step into the story now. You know, we're holding, you know, the claims made up in ink in the newspapers against records that don't quite lie so easily. So when we look into stories, we're looking at census records, marriage license, timelines that either support the story or quietly contradict it. So Anna Kaha married George Schlesinger on February 15th, 1900 in Frank, Russia. She was 19 and George was 24. They built their early life in Russia and welcomed two children, Marie, who was often called Mary in the newspapers, was born in 1903, and their son, Carl, followed in 1906. In 1913, the family made a life-altering decision, and they left Russia, traveled through Liverpool, and crossed the Atlantic aboard SS Ivrona. On March 28, 1913, they entered the U.S. through Boston, and they later settled in Lincoln, Nebraska. Two more children were born. There was Frida in 1915. I like that name, Frida. It's cute. And Freddie in 1917. But by 1920, the Schlesingers were no longer newcomers. They had roots, a reputation, and something to protect. I didn't have many newspaper articles. I think I had a handful. That was it to go off of, and then documents. But according to the Lincoln Star, 16-year-old Marie Schlesinger ran away from her parents' home after what she described as a forced marriage to a neighbor. Marie told officials that her parents had arranged the marriage without her consent. She said she wasn't even informed about the wedding until it was happening the moment before the ceremony. Oh my God. And she claimed the marriage license had been obtained without her knowledge and that her age had been falsely listed as 19 by her father.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, thanks. She reported that she cried through the ceremony, and after leaving home, Marie sought protection from the Social Welfare Society. She repeated her story to officials, identifying her husband as Alex Hoff, a neighbor who they met at the Beets field when they were working. Mm-hmm. Marie alleged that after she left, her husband contacted police in an attempt to force her to return, and she, but the police refused it. They kind of just were like, no, we're not doing that. The article closes by stating that Marie feared for her life if she couldn't find help, and they did mention the word planned suicide. So,
oh, gosh.
Yeah, so she was kept overnight under Welfare Society supervision and then taken to the detention home where she awaited the possibility of annulment for, you know, hoping that she could get this taken care of. But that wasn't the only version of events that appeared in the print. The day after the first article ran, Marie's parents publicly denied forcing her daughter into marriage. They claimed Marie married of her own choice and suggested she had been influenced by friends to run away. They described a willing courtship, letters, visits, and shared excitement. They said Marie participated happily in weddings, wedding preparations, and social gatherings afterward. In their version, nothing was forced, nothing was hidden, and responsibility they implied laid elsewhere.
Like, were they, like, a well-known family in this town, or was
it
this...
It seemed like a small town. It seemed like a lot of their neighbors were from Russia as well, okay. So I feel like they probably built a community around that point in time. So just days before the scandal broke, the Lincoln Star printed a marriage license notice. You know those? They show up in the newspaper. It was dated January 20th, 1920. Alex Hoff, age 23, of Scotts Bluff, and Mary Schlesinger of Lincoln, listed as 19 years old, like she had said. On paper, it's clean, legal, uncomplicated, but the census has started to tell us a little bit of a different story. So the 1920 census was enumerated on January 8th, less than 2 weeks earlier, lists Marie Schlesinger living at home with her parents and siblings, her age 16, like she stated. Her age, her marriage status, single. And in the span of 12 days, Marie appeared as both a minor child and an adult bride. And that discrepancy matters.
It's not right.
No.
Someone's lying.
Yes. So Marie did get her day in court.
Oh, good.
After going to the welfare.
That's surprising. Society.
Yes.
That is surprising to me.
So Judge W.M. Morning concluded that the parties were lawfully married, and he brought together Marie, Alex, their parents, the pastor, and about a handful of relatives in an attempt to reach a solution.
They're married?
They are legally married.
Okay.
At this point. Says but the judge.
Is he letting her get out of it?
So that's what they're all...
Okay.
Everybody's going to have an opinion.
Okay.
Bring the whole room.
Yeah. But, really, if she doesn't want to be married, shouldn't it just be done?
Right. Yeah. So, they have a private discussion, and then Hoffs reported that Marie had once changed her mind again, as the records sort of were going back and forth that she kept changing her mind, and decided to accompany her husband to his home and to be a good wife to him.
What the heck?
Yeah.
What is going on? Is she
I'm just thinking this room full of people probably trying to put their opinions of what
am I going to do next if I don't do this?
Right.
My parents won't take me back. What are the opportunities I have?
Yeah. So, Marie told the judge she had known Alex since childhood in Russia. So, the families were together, I guess, in Russia. They reconnected a year prior while working in the beet fields, and they exchanged letters, and she returned to Lincoln. One of the letters did ask her to become his wife. Her decision wavered repeatedly. This is her saying. She accepted.
Yeah.
She didn't decline. She accepted again. She refused again. At one point, she said she didn't want to leave Lincoln because she was paying for a piano on installments purchased with her own earnings.
Aww.
Poor little 60, she doesn't want to worry about marriage. She wants to play her piano.
She loves the piano more than this guy.
Yeah, true. She changed her mind, they said, at least 5 times in a span of 30 days or something. And at one point, he came to Lincoln, and him and his mother appeared at the store, I believe, at which she worked, to continue discussing what she was going to do. It just seems like a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Even more proof that she was a teenage girl ready to be married.
Yeah. So the judge turned the case over to Reverend Richard Calhoun, who performed the ceremony, and they all sat in district court with the family again and the community members. And her parents suggested another layer to the story, that Marie liked another person, Wesley Siegfried, who they said was married but not living with his wife. She stated after that Hoff proposed to her and her parents told her it was all right, and she began to think it was all right too. Just trying to listen to her parents, And in the census records in 1920, Marie was on page 18,
mm-hmm.
and the Siegfried Reeds were on page 20.
Oh.
So they were obviously part of the
neighbors,
community.
Yeah.
I know in the articles they said that Alex was a neighbor, but he lived in a different county. So I don't know if they were maybe neighbors in Russia.
Maybe.
So the pastor who performed the ceremony stated that Marie appeared happy during the wedding, smiling as she answered the vows. He described a traditional Russian wedding supper complete with the selling of the bride's shoes at $4 a pair, which I guess is a customary thing they do.
Interesting. I had no idea about that.
Yeah. So Marie agreed that, in part because she said she did not want to be a divorced woman, despite saying she didn't love her husband really, and she thought she was too young to be married. So you're just getting these conflicting views, right? They're saying she's doing it and she's happy doing it, and then she's like, no, I changed my mind, I regret it. The last newspaper article I read was from January 27th, 1920, and it read, "It is presumed that the newlyweds are now happily settled."
So she just gave up. Settled down.
Yeah.
And
so this is where it's interesting, because I've never come across this, but the newspapers moved on, but the consequence really didn't. By February 1920, Marie appeared again on the census. So they must have gone to the parents' house first to do the 1920 census. And then they finally made it to the county where Alex was living. And she was listed again on the census.
Weird.
Yeah, because it was off by a month. So it was the Scotts Bluff County 1920 census listed her living with Alex Hoff, age 17, and living with his parents and his siblings.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. Weird.
So, yeah. By March, though, so another month later, Alex Hoff publicly declared he was not responsible for debts contracted by his wife. And then by August...
So he's not paying for that piano? No, is that... Oh, my gosh.
By August, Marie sought an annulment, alleged cruelty and abuse, and she asked the court to compel support for an unborn child.
Oh, man.
So, in November of 1920, Judge Mooring granted her divorce, citing, you know, her claim that Alex refused to allow communication with her family, and I dug around. There was no evidence that I could find of a surviving child from the marriage.
Oh.
So whether the newspapers were just playing that up, could have been adopted, could have been hidden, could have just not happened.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know. I didn't see anything. I looked at, like, the grandparents. I looked at, like, I followed their life, right. And I never saw, like, a someone who was taking the child in, you know,
right.
Like their own. So on March 14th, 1923, Nebraska, Marie eventually married Victor G. Siegfried.
Is that the other guy?
So.
Was so it?
Marie
Did
was
he 19- divorce his other wife?
Marie was 19, Victor 28.
Okay.
And the last name is familiar to you because he is the older brother of Wesley, the person
oh
his parents
God.
Once suggested she cared for.
This girl is stressing me out.
when I found that, I was like, wow. At first, I was like, oh my gosh, she married her true love.
No.
No.
The older brother.
They were a couple years apart, I think 3 years. His family had immigrated from Russia in 1892, but Victor himself was born in Washington. And following Wesley, because I just wanted to know what happened to him, he got married. There was a potential divorce situation, but they must have worked it out because they continued on. But the 1930 census shows that they were now living in Lincoln, and Victor owned a barber shop. And in this one of the censuses, Wesley was a barber. So I'm like, oh, imagine if they were, like, working together and she had to see him all the time. Or, you know, I don't know. Anyway, they had two daughters, Daryline, which was
That's cute.
Pretty, and Irene.
Oh.
Similar. Victor was listed as a veteran. He was a PFC, U.S. Army, World War I vet. And in her later times, it looked like she was involved in different clubs for the veterans, and she kind
okay.
of helped with all that.
Cool.
By 1940 and 1950, the family had relocated to Washington State, where he was born, and Marie worked steadily, listed as an egg candler.
Oh.
I've never seen that. I had to look it up. If it's what I was looking at, it's pretty much like holding up eggs and making sure that the embryos are healthy.
Interesting.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. If you're listening and know more about egg candler jobs, let me know. Victor worked as a farmer and then changed professions and was now working as a broker in real estate at that time. She ended up becoming a citizen, and we know kind of how she looked because it was described in those documents. She had brown hair, brown eyes, just over 5 feet tall. She was like
Aww.
5 feet 2.5 inches, it said, weighing 155 pounds and had a distinct mole on her forehead and left cheek.
Hmm.
I could not find anything on Ancestry with pictures. I was hoping like a family
yeah.
had posted, you know, pictures, but I didn't see anything like that. And there's obviously nothing in the newspapers of photos. But Marie eventually died November 26, 1973 at the age of 70 in Spokane, Washington. And she died from a heart attack and was buried in Fairmont Memorial Park, Spokane, Washington. And her husband died within a year after her.
Okay.
Maybe, hopefully one of those, like, those true love things. So Marie lived a long life, but her story reminds us of how narrow the margins of choice can be for young girls like herself. At 16, she wasn't reckless, she wasn't dramatic, she wasn't trying to cause trouble. She was trying to just do what she thought she should do, please her parents, protect her reputation, support herself, play the piano. You know,
right.
She just wanted to play the piano that she's working so hard for. So we're kind of left with questions that records can't answer, unfortunately. My questions are, was she ever really given a choice? yeah. based off the conflicting documents. Which version of the marriage was true? Who benefited most from the story being told that way? And really, how many love triangles built not from passion but from pressure are still, you know, hiding quietly in family trees? I'm sure yeah. it happens more often than not.
Yeah, I feel like my story was also
same, right. That sounds like it's kind of weird. Yeah, it goes together. The pressure to just
do. I mean, women don't have as many options as men do. Let's exactly. just put it out there.
Exactly. No, I definitely agree. So it was definitely a tangled mess for me to try to figure out. Everyone kind of moved on. Alex moved on. He had one child later in life. Got married. So it was definitely an interesting story there. But I do have a shadows from the tree spotlight.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Okay, so my mom told me this story.
Oh.
And it completely changed the way I looked at this little tower in South Kingstown. I'm going to show you. If you've seen this on the Wood of the Beaches. Yeah. Do you know this story?
Not at all, no.
Okay. Well, I did a little bit of digging myself after my mom shared it with me. I passed by it 100 times on the way to the beach and didn't really know until now. So, it's called the Hannah Robinson Tower. So, she was born in 1746, the daughter of a wealthy Rhode Island family. Growing up in the Boston area, she had all the privileges you can imagine, but her heart belonged to someone her family would never approve of. Oh. Supposedly a teacher, Peter Simond. Her father, you know, said he wasn't suitable. He controlled her life, her inheritance, her future, and just said he wasn't a match. So Hannah and Peter still found a way. They secretly corresponded, met in secret, and eventually eloped, leaving behind the wealth and safety of her family.
Wow.
So you imagine that. You're leaving everything that you've known just to follow your true love, right? So knowing that your family would be furious on the other side, and they were. Her father disowned her, even offering reward for anyone who had helped her escape. She and Peter struggled to make a life in Providence, far from the home she grew up in, so they kind of had some struggles. Eventually, her father softened and brought her back, but by then, Hannah was ill and heartbroken. She died in 1773, only 27 years old, and that little tower that we passed by, it wasn't built while she was alive. It was built later, in 1938, but it was made to mark the spot that she loved to sit and gaze out over the land that she grew up on, the life that she had been forced to leave because of the choices that she had made.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important because I couldn't really look. I didn't go down a big rabbit hole because I was like, that time period's hard to find.
Yeah, that's way back.
Yeah, it's really hard to find, but you know, she was a daughter, a wife, she had a death date and names, but we wouldn't have known any of that until right. digging into the story. So that's kind of, everything I was reading was telling the same sort of story, but it's almost like folklore, right? Like,
yeah.
told over time. But it is, I've been up there, I don't know if you have.
Yeah, I've been up there once or twice, yeah.
But yeah, so that's the story of the little thing. I would love to probably dive into that more, but I was just like, interesting. This poor yeah. girl.
That's funny how your mom remembered that.
I know. Forced to, you know, leave her family just for her own love. So that's it. That's all what right. I got. And I'm sure there's other love triangles out there. So please, please, please share them on Facebook. Send us an email.
Yep. shadowsfromthetree@gmail.com.
Yep. And that wraps up
season three. We Michelle. Did it.
Awesome. All right. Thanks for listening.